Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work in some strange way. And today, I'm really excited to have writer Kiwi Smith with me. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for coming out in this balmy afternoon that we were just talking about. For those of you who aren't familiar with Kiwi's work, I mean, where have you been? Please let me give you an introduction. Kirsten Kiwi Smith is a Washington native who moved to L.A. to attend Occidental College before uprooting to NYU to study film. Before becoming a screenwriter, she was a poet and has had her poetry and essays published in more than 30 literary journals like Rookie, the Gettysburg Review, and L.A. Review of Books. If you went to like an MFA in fiction and poetry like I did, you're like, oh, Gettysburg Review. But I don't know, like what people, like our listeners would be like, Gettysburg Review. I'm like, oh,
right.
Very prestigious.
Oh, I mean, it's like one of the greatest accomplishments of my life.
It's a pretty good journal.
Thank you.
It's like, definitely pick it up. Her first YA novel, The Geography of Girlhood, was a novel in verse. Early in her career, though, Kiwi was reading and noting up scripts at Cinetel, which took her on the film development path. From there, Kiwi teamed up with the writer Karen McCullough, and the two sold their first spec script, which is a little movie you might know called 10 Things I Hate About You. From there, Kiwi went on to co-write Legally Blonde, She's the Man, Ella Enchanted, The Ugly Truth, and The House Bunny, a string of movies that imbued seemingly simple female archetypes with complex, nuanced emotions. She recently executive produced and created the half-hour Netflix series Trinkets, based on her YA novel, which was recently reprinted as a tie-in you can get at Barnes & Noble right now. Mm-hmm. Audiobook is available, too. I know you podcast nerds might like that. Trinkets is light crime, we'd call it, female friendship story, in which our leading lady is intrigued by an untouchably beautiful girl who forms a friendship with her, and the two begin to share a shoplifting addiction. Mm. So Kiwi is also co-author of two comic book series, Misfit City and Smooth Criminals, the latter of which is a female buddy heist crime story. And you can find her on Twitter or Instagram at Kiwi Loves You.
Hello.
Kiwi, do you really love people?
I feel like I do. I mean, that became a handle and a corporation name when I realized that attorneys were reading contracts that had my name, and I felt that they might be sad in a room, and so then they could see Kiwi Loves You, and they would feel less alone.
I love this so much. This is exactly what I would expect, and it's a great story. I love this. Kiwi, the movie that you chose to talk about today, I'm real excited. It's one that I hadn't seen before you had suggested it. It is Bob Rafelson's Black Widow.
Yes.
Could you give me a little explanation of, you know, why this is one of your fave genre films?
Well, I think it's one of my favorites. It came out in 1986. I saw it in the movie theater. Mm-hmm. I was an impressionable teen, and I grew up in Seattle. Part of the movie shot in Seattle, so that was a bit of catnip. But I loved the story of this female cop who was kind of underestimated in her job. She lived in this male-dominated world of the Department of Justice, and she becomes obsessed with this really mysterious, shape-shifting Black Widow, a woman mm-hmm. who marries men and kills them for money. And it's really... It becomes like a love story, a warped love story, a story of obsession between these two women who are kind of rocked out of their world, their male-dominated worlds, and sort of they refocus onto each other. And mm-hmm. I just found that I was always finding myself in trance with some fascinating rock goddess or pop icon or cool girl, cool older girl or something. And so I really identified with that feeling of like, who is this woman? How can I evolve as I, you know, through my interest in her, and how mm-hmm. can I become friends with her? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I really wanted to like, you know, get in a cat and mouse game the way the movie is.
Yeah, but, exactly. Like, you know, maybe not like a murder cat and mouse game. Like, that's potentially too far for you, Kiwi, but
right.
But I see your point. For those of you who haven't seen Black Widow, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch, as always. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Black Widow, this is your chance.
Mm.
And now that you're back, please let me introduce Black Widow with a quick synopsis. Written by Ronald Bass and directed by Bob Rafelson for release in 1986, Black Widow opens with a mysterious woman, Catherine, watching as her toymaker husband keels over. We jump over to DOJ desk jockey Alex, played by Deborah Winger, who's noticing something strange about this tycoon man's death.
Two guys die within 4 days of each other. What does that say to you?
It's chalked up to Ondine's curse, which is like the first time I had heard of that. I was like, Ondine's curse?
Yeah.
You guys gotta look this up.
Maren Gano ran trash collection for half a jersey. You don't die in your sleep with something called...
Ondine's curse. Damage of unknown origin to the part of the brain that controls breathing. It's rare. It's real. It happens.
Through a period of years, we see Catherine show up and completely change her mannerisms and appearance, pleasing the man she wants to be with. In the meantime, Alex is growing ever more bored at her desk and ever more concerned about the mysterious wives of these dead rich men. In all pictures, she notices that the wives look away from cameras instinctively, so there's never a great picture of them. She proffers to her boss that it's all the same person.
She doesn't want pictures. She knows the camera's there. She turns away, I can tell.
The Texas one is different. She's got a slimmer body.
No, it's the way she stands.
She's younger, Alex, at least 5 years
That's
younger.
That's makeup, hair, attitude.
I think you're wrong.
I could be right.
They've got a Black Widow on their hands, apparently.
Yes.
But her boss, who clearly has a crush on her, says that Alex is just too obsessed with her work and needs to get a personal life.
Bruce, I've been in this office for 6 years, this goddamn government office with green windows.
Yeah, I know. You want excitement. Well, a lot of people don't look to get it all from their job.
Alex gets permission to tail this woman, whom she's tracked down from her attachment to a wealthy museum curator. Alex says she's a journalist researching a story about powerful women, and when word gets back to Catherine, her chain is deeply rattled. Still, Catherine does go through with it and offs her husband, disappearing again. Alex was this close. Time passes. Alex is bearing down on this Catherine, who's now shown up as a fresh-faced beach babe in Hawaii, trying to tempt a wealthy European hotelier, Paul.
And there's a lot of talk about her hair. Her hair is incredible. And
it's
Deborah
beautiful.
Winger has curly hair, which is, of course, in the 80s, like a really complicated thing to have. It
yep.
still is, but she sees Teresa Russell's hair, and she's like, ooh, your hair. And
yeah.
He's having a party tonight. Do you want to come?
Oh, I can't. I left all my designer stuff back in Chicago.
Well, that's all right. You can borrow something of mine.
Can I borrow your hair?
Her body is a weapon. We'll get to that later.
Yes, but it is. I love Teresa Russell, who plays this. Okay, so Alex assumes the name Jesse and befriends Catherine easily in Hawaii. But Catherine catches on that Jesse isn't who she says she is. Still, their friendship seems real, even though its cat and mouse-ness is kind of overwhelming. Catherine wants to help Alex break out of her shell, and Alex does want to help Catherine feel more genuine emotions, perhaps remorse. Alex goes to one of Paul's parties with her, and Paul shows interest in Alex.
Would you like to dance?
No, thanks. I have new shoes.
Catherine helps set up Alex and Paul, seemingly abandoning her next marriage plot, but she also hires a PI to take photos of Alex and Paul together. What is Catherine doing? Catherine seems to change her mind then, seducing Paul, and then the two get married. Alex is really, really betrayed. And, you know, she was trusting Catherine.
I helped you get here, didn't I? When you put us together, it made him want you all the more. So I guess you could say my wedding gift was the groom.
So she fell for Paul and it didn't work out. But one weekend, Catherine goes out of town. Her MO for murdering husbands is when she goes out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex tries to tip him off that Catherine's going to kill him.
Under three different names, she married three different men, all wealthy men.
What are you trying?
Paul, she killed all of them. She poisoned them. Now she's left town, and that's when they die, when she's gone.
News reports that Paul has died, and Catherine uses her PI's photos to frame Alex. Alex is arrested. Catherine comes to visit her in jail, kind of to gloat. And in their conversation, Catherine reveals how she killed Paul. But joke's on her, because it was all a setup to get Catherine's confession, and Catherine is arrested.
It's so sad.
I know.
It's a sad ending.
It's a really it's a sad ending because, you know, they also kind of like each other. They don't want to hurt each other, but they keep doing it.
Yeah.
Before we get into the main conversation, I want to give a shout out to Robert Fisher, who is the director of some of the special features on the UK Blu-ray, specifically a film where he's interviewing Ronald Bass. It's not that easy to find materials on the this film, yeah. but, you know, Robert Fisher was so kind to send me a link, and I just want to thank him for helping me with my research today. But let's get into the idea that neither Rafelson nor Bass thought that they were making a noir movie. Really? Yeah. They didn't think they were making a noir.
It's like a tropical noir because it's all in the most of it's in Hawaii. So yeah. I like that idea of it. How could they not, though? The opening shot is basically like it's such a great opening with their mirror, the mirror shot where like one eye is in focus and then the other eye is not. It's like, what did they think they were making?
So
it wasn't a noir.
So Bass said that he thought he's like, I don't even know the term neo noir. There's noir and there's not. He was like, it wasn't a genre film. It was a girlfriend film, a self-esteem film.
A self-esteem film?
I thought you would love that.
That's so weird. What? He did not know what he was talking. He doesn't know his own work. That's okay. Sometimes writers don't. I mean, I guess there is a makeover scene in the movie, which is like part of it being a self-esteem film, I guess. But yeah. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Here's the thing about Ronald Bass, and we should say Ronald Bass also Academy Award winning writer.
Yes,
who did
for Rain Man.
And
My Best Friend's Wedding, a classic romantic comedy, and Sleeping with the Enemy.
Yeah,
sort of stalker Julia Roberts thriller.
Great movie too.
Mm-hmm.
He employs like a stable of 8 women who write with him, and he was able to pump out scripts very quickly because he employed 8 women writers behind him who wrote things with or for him.
I have heard about this, and I've never heard the specific number 8.
I think it was 8.
And it would be so cool to like hear more about that process and know who some of those writers were and if they went on to any kind of writing careers of their own without being under the moniker of his name. I wonder, do you know?
Here's the thing. I was actually looking for that. I thought that would be really wonderful to be able to bring up.
Do you think that 2 of the 8 writers who might have been helping write this movie became obsessed with each other and got to role play Catherine and Alex? And do you think that maybe not in my mind? Perhaps
it's good to happen. I love that.
One of the curious things about this movie is that David Mamet has a cameo in it in
playing
the poker
cards.
Scene.
Yeah.
And so I had this theory that maybe he was like working on the script or doing some sort of dialogue polish on the script because it seemed odd that he was in the film. And there was a lot of. There's great dialogue in the movie, and it seems like, okay, maybe that was a Mamet line, but I didn't know it was a Vanna line.
Yeah. We don't know who.
Who is Vanna? And this is a mystery. Like, she's trying to figure out who is Catherine.
Yeah.
We're trying to figure out who's Vanna.
Who the fuck is Vanna? I mean, if Vanna's out there still, please tell us who you are. I think the David Mamet cameo is something that I think I could probably explain just from a few things of research. And for those of you guys who haven't watched the movie, he is playing cards, playing poker, and Alex, she plays poker with all the guys. You know, she's a bit of a tomboy. She doesn't really embrace her femininity. And they cast David Mamet in that role because they were like, we want a man's man here.
Oh.
We want to like symbolically be like, this is the guy who writes men, you know?
Oh, weird.
And so it was just like, here's the man guy at the table and she's sitting opposite him. And also the fact that, you know, something that Ronald Bass loved is that, you know, you just mention a name to Bob Riefelson, Dennis Hopper, for instance, and it'd be like, okay, yeah, let's get him for the small role. Any person, and they were like, oh, yeah, David Mamet. And they can just get him for a fucking cameo.
So great.
But, you know, one would hope that maybe he did a few zingers on the script, too.
Right. That's so. And doesn't he have a little line in it where someone says, like, did you ask her out? Because everyone in the office is, like, trying to ask out Deborah Winger, and she's just married to her job. And What did he say? Oh, like he says that he took her to a Bulls game, and they're like, what happened? And then Mamet says, the Bulls lost.
I love that line. I mean, like, you're getting into the dialogue, so let's maybe get into the dialogue and creating this kind of realistic dialogue. In your work as well, you know, you have... a really, like I was saying in your introduction, your bio, you know, these are seemingly characters that we've seen in movies before, but they're real. You know, there's a kind of realness that's at, and obviously that is so much of like this honed dialogue of trying to create real and robust women specifically.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that kind of process and,
yeah.
and, you know, how you veto the bad ones, you know, that kind of thing?
Right. I mean, I don't work with a stable of eight women, but I do work in a mini stable with often in collaboration. And Karen and I, who I've written a lot of movies with, my longtime collaborator, a lot of times we're writing out loud. So we're kind of just talking to each other and pitching lines to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we're writing to sort of please each other. And if she says something great, she's on a roll, I'll be writing it all down.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I say something, she'll write it down. Or we just kind of build it like line by line, couplet by couplet as we go forth. And if we're working on a joke, it's, you know, whenever something one of us says makes us laugh, it goes in. That wasn't always our process. When we first met, we wrote 10 things. We lived in different states, so we wrote 10 things I hate about you in two different places.
Yeah.
And we got together and outlined the movie, and then we wrote separate scenes. We mailed them to each other because it was like a pre-email time.
Oh, wow.
And then we would rewrite each other. And so sometimes that would lead to disputes back and forth. And we found that our happier place was when we were getting together to rewrite based on other people's notes. So then we could be like, fuck their notes. Okay, fine. Well, I guess we have to do them. We're forced to do. Okay. And then we would get together and be like unified against an evil authority instead of being against each other, you know?
Yeah. I like
so,
that.
So I don't know. We tend to write more things in the same room with each other now, which is really, it's really fun. And it's hot out. So we can sit by the pool and we can make our own tropical noir stories by the pool.
Yeah. But you do, I mean, like, definitely face-to-face.
Face-to-face, yep. Yeah, face-to-face. And, I mean, we love crime stories. We're always trying to write mysteries. We're always selling mystery ideas. And then once we get into it, we're like, oh, fuck, we have to, like, crack a mystery plot. So that is always...
It's hard, dude.
We haven't gotten any of our mysteries made. And our mysteries obviously have a comedic... elements and tone but it's really the building blocks of a mystery is super hard. I think that's one of the things I like about Black Widow is it's sort of a simple mystery in a way. It's sort of a character driven mystery, which I like.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get a little bit further into Teresa Russell.
Yes.
A little bit further into some of Ronald Bass's process on this and also how the story came about from the pitch. But we'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Tusk Henderson, and I am an outdoorsman.
Are you looking for a new comedy podcast? This month's episode of Beef and Dairy Network podcast has as its guest the wonderful Nick Offerman, playing the part of Tusk Henderson, adventurer and outdoorsman.
Think about fitting yourself, a month's worth of provisions, and a half-ton cow into a kayak.
So if you've never listened to the show before, this might be a good place to start.
I string a bowstring between her horn tips and I can fire a spear off the top of her head and took in some very delicious cod.
So if you're after a new comedy podcast, why not try the Beef and Dairy Network from Maximum Fun? Download it now.
You flip a cow upside down, they make an excellent toboggan.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Kiwi Smith, and we're talking about Black Widow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, you had also mentioned you know, when we were talking about dialogues, I want to back up just a little bit. When we were talking about dialogue and the way that you guys write, which is kind of back and forth, making each other laugh sometimes, just trying to get that realism in there. And I want to talk about something that Ronald Bass said about his earlier career. He said, quote, "I've always over-directed and over-revealed in my writing. Barry Diller, when he read the script," Barry Diller, who was at Fox, "this kid said, this kid will never make it because he has all this prose where he's telling you what everyone is thinking or feeling. And he puts full stops in his sentences to tell you when to breathe and how to talk. And that day I was writing, if the character would say, I don't know, I would say, I don't know. Because it seemed rhythmically to be the natural speech. I do a lot less of that now." But apparently the script for Black Widow did have those tendencies. This is the first script that Ronald Bass had sold.
Oh, wow.
And so he did have all of those kind of colloquialisms and things in the script. And Deborah Winger took him to task and did a reading of it, and did a reading of it where she over-enunciated every single word that he had written, like, "I dun know," you know, like that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
And then Bob Riefelson was just like, "See."
She's tough.
I love her.
I love her too.
Everyone says she's kind of bitchy or whatever, but that woman is just like, she's good enough to be whatever the fuck she wants to be, you know?
She was like pretty, she was at a high point in her career when she made this movie too. I think it was post Officer and a Gentleman, which was shot in my hometown, Port Townsend, Washington. So she kind of probably had her pick of scripts at this point.
She did. And actually,
Urban Cowboy was around this time.
Same thing. And one of the things that was really difficult for them was that she was the largest female star at this time.
Wow.
when they cast her. There was like a window of time where she was like it.
Yeah.
And they really, really wanted her to play Catherine. They wanted her to play Teresa Russell's role.
Oh,
and she didn't. And in fact, quote, this is from Ronald Bass, "We always wanted Deborah. She was the biggest star in that way and a genius actress and an interesting person. We all wanted her to play the killer, though. She insisted on playing the cop. Fox gave her the right to name a list of actresses to play the killer, and she came back with a list of one. Teresa Russell was the only name on that list. And if they didn't use Teresa, she wouldn't do the film."
I am tearing up right now. That is so cool.
That bitch will fight for you, right? That's who I want on
my side. Deborah loves you.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Wow. I love that she handpicked Teresa Russell.
But I think, you know, if you look at the way that I tried to imagine Deborah Winger as the killer. And I can definitely see that, you know, because they like this was a time where like Deborah Winger was like sex appeal. Like that was like when men looked at her, they were like, yes. And she was like, no, I'm going to do a little bit frumpy and a little bit tomboy. Like that's a lot of courage to have if you're like a woman at the height of your kind of sex appeal career, you know?
Yeah. It's also maybe a little bit of a fuck you, too.
Yeah, it is.
It's like I'm in this world where you want me to be the sexy one. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I think I'm going to go be the one who's like the studying the sexy one or kind of melding with the sexy one. Because I feel like those characters are two halves of a weird 80s female coin, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like the sort of underestimated workaholic and then the like seductive, you know, woman who just is like lures men.
Let's talk about these archetypes too.
Okay.
Because they're real interesting to get into. Deborah Winger's character, what you said, is, you know, like the overworked 80s woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that was like we could see edging into a lot of films around that time. You know, Mr. Mom was like a huge comedy. And that was about like a guy who had to take over for an overworked, you know, wife.
Yeah.
And everyone was like changing into pumps at the office. And it was just a different time. And I'm just curious, did that kind of trope ever influence you when you were working on some things like Legally Blonde or any of that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I feel like all of these movies, I mean, Working Girl and the idea that you could be both kind of sexual and feminine and be out there slaying it in the workforce was, I think, one of the things about Elle Woods that was really appealing. And people seem to, it seems to have stood the test of time as well. But yeah, just also the kind of scrappy, but also scrappy and sexy. I mean, I mean, Working Girl Melanie Griffith, that was a great example of like a woman who was, she was so sensual and also so smart. And yeah, I think that huge, huge influence. But also being, I mean, I love Deborah Winger's attitude of this kind of defiant, like, she had a defiant streak. Like, guys were telling her, no, you need to stay in the office and you need to do like your research. And she's like, I want to go out in the field. And I like that. I like that kind of anarchistic, like, fuck you to patriarchy.
And she has that moment where her boss like sticks his hand down like her chest, and it's like he's like giving her a back rub because they're close, right? They're like really close friends, but he wants to be closer, and he like lets his hand slip a little bit between her breasts. And the elegant way that she brushes him off is something that I was just like, that scene in itself, I think, is so beautifully directed, so beautifully acted. She just like, she kind of like completely changes the subject. She's like a master of it. It's almost like she's not even affected by it. She's just like switch is turned off, and then she like, she redirects him so brilliantly.
Yeah, I know. You're right. It's wild. I mean, there's another great scene too. She has so much control, it seems, over her sexuality. Remember the guy, the coworker who asks her out, and she says no, she doesn't want to. And then he finds some key piece of research in the case about Catherine, and she like runs up and like kisses him on the mouth. So it's like she's in control of when she gets to drive like a sexually charged interaction. Like, she'll kiss you, but only if you're finding out good research about the case.
Yeah. And, you know, she dreams bigger than what anyone else wants to do for her. You know? She brings that gun to work one day and she's just like, what?
Right.
That's target practice, you know?
Right. Gun, a.k.a. phallus. Then also the scene where she meets Catherine she's giving her like CPR. Like, basically they have a great kissing scene.
Yeah.
It's so gay in the best way.
Yeah, but I have...
Oh, you know, we don't get to that yet.
No, I actually have something. Ronald Bass actually had some ideas about whether or not there's, like, any kind of sexual attraction between the two. Because...
I mean, yes, there is so much. It's, like, it's oozing off the screen.
Here's the thing, though. Like, this is what Ronald Bass thinks, right?
What?
Quote, the fact of sexual attraction between the women was never explored in the film. There was warmth and intimacy. Did either of them fantasize they wanted to have sex with each other? I would say no. But you have one person who was completely adventurous and would never have thought about anything about it. She might do it out of desire to trap her prey. In those days, you wouldn't do that because it takes over. It's like pineapple on a pizza. It's a flavor that wipes everything else away in the movie. It just becomes a lesbian movie then. You want to do that? Do what Todd Haynes does and do that story wonderfully. Don't just throw it in with something else.
Wow.
Thoughts about that, Kiwi?
Well, I feel like they totally are obsessed with each other, and it feels pretty electric. I mean, I feel like it's a little bit of a love triangle in the back half of the movie with Paul. But I feel like they basically are having sex with him because they want to have sex with each other. I mean, that was my reading on it. And then they're sort of playing this, like, sexual one-upmanship of, like, who can fuck him better than the other. And obviously, Teresa Russell wins that battle. But it's, yeah, it seems like, I mean, they just are, when they even meet and they're in their bikinis and they're in the swimming pool, they're in the water. And then they're sort of looking at each other's bodies and saying, it's just a sort of lingering, like, let's look at each other and figure out how to be more like each other, i.e. sort of how to marry together. It seems pretty erotic to me. And then they swim again, and they almost drown in the ocean, and they have to, like, share the scuba mask to get... I mean, it all seems layered in a great way.
Yeah.
Like, and then Teresa Russell saves her just because continuing the flirtation and the back and forth is way more exciting than just dating Paul.
It's weird. I can see things both ways from Ronald's point of view, right? I think that he does have a point in terms of just like, are you just going to flavor this with a lesbian affair, you know?
Yeah.
Like, does it feel real? Or are you going to do, like, what Todd Haynes does and like, make something feel real and the characters have these genuine emotions for each other?
Yeah.
And I think that that's great. But also at the same time, like, wouldn't it be great if we just kind of, like, normalized lesbian relationships? I think at that time, maybe in 1986, it would be a little bit more of, like, what he's saying, pineapple on the pizza, where it's just, like, it sucks the oxygen out of the room because you're like, oh, God, women kissing. Heavens, you know.
Right.
So I can understand that in terms of the context of that time. But you can't deny that maybe one or two of his, like, stable of women writers was like, no, this is definitely them, like, in love with each other.
Yeah.
I mean, for you, like, writing any characters who are, you know, like, attracted to same sex or, you know, maybe pansexual or anything like that, do you think about, you know, the, like, the audience reception of that? Like, are they going to get caught off guard by it? Are they, you know, like, what does that mean to you when you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, I have in Trinkets, the Netflix show, which is a YA show, the lead character is queer. And it was, I mean, it felt just perfectly of the moment and time because it's so many, I mean, gender so fluid, sexuality so fluid for a young adult audience in
particular. Gen Z, they're so easy to embrace it now.
Yeah. So that felt like a strong choice and update from my novel where she was straight in it. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we're writing a romantic comedy now where one of the characters is gay. And I mean, I feel like now more than ever, that's something that you will only enhance your story and only be more real and true to life.
Because it's pretty normal. Who the hell doesn't have a gay friend, isn't gay?
Right. I mean, I just feel like I've always, I mean, I identify as straight, but I just feel like I'm always really more interested in girls. Like, I'm interested in movies about girls. I'm interested in friendship stories. I'm interested in female relationships, female ensembles, female lead characters. So, yeah.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit into kind of the milieu of the 1980s films, how this fits in there, and the philosophy of structuring this movie. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Janet Varney, and like many of you, brand new sentient robots excluded, I used to be a teenager. In fact, just about all of my friends were, too, including folks like comedian Danielle Radford.
And of course, all of us, you take on that theater accent, and our teacher would say, no, that isn't how people talk.
Right.
Don't do the super theater kid accent. It's the worst. But so when I was doing theater in high school, of course, I immediately was talking about being in the theater.
So join me every week on the JV Club podcast, where I speak with my favorite women artists, innovators, and humans as we reminisce about the past and how it led us to becoming who we are. Find it every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Kiwi Smith, and we're talking about Black Widow. So when Rafelson was reflecting on this kind of movie-making career that he had, is obviously a really kind of temperamental, interesting figure, very interesting figure, a lot of weird jobs that he had before he started making films. He said, quote, "When I started making films in the late 60s, I had the good fortune that despite the fact that my films broke with popular taste, they were synchronous enough with an attitude of the time to be successful. We're now going through a period that reminds me of the 1950s and that there's very little defection from popular taste. We don't seem to hear the voice of the minority very loudly these days, whereas when I started out, that voice was a bit more clear." And I thought that was an interesting thing where when he was talking about coming back to Black Widow, because this is the first movie that he had made with 5 years off, there was an incident where he punched someone on set and he was thrown off this show or movie. I can't even remember which one it was. So he took some time off and he like went hiking around the world, like,
wow.
Got into his old hobby of anthropology and archaeology, and then came back and was like, yeah, I'm going to make this movie. And this was kind of his not like a mea culpa. It was like, hey, I'm back. You can't get rid of me. I'm going to make something a little bit more mainstream, but it's also going to be weird.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his answer to the movies of the 1980s. And I was wondering if you could talk about your experiences of working with different kinds of directors. And
I mean, Robert Luketic directed Legally Blonde and The Ugly Truth. Mm-hmm. And he was, I mean, he's very prepared. And he comes in and just, like, wants to capture and do just a few takes and get it and move on and keeps it very, like, light and fast-paced and super collaborative with us in terms of if there's any kind of story thing, or he, like, would pull us in and we would be there to work beside him for any time he needed it, which is not always the case. Sometimes on other projects, directors are more wanting to say, thank you for the script. Now let me go shoot it and do what I like. Mm-hmm. And Robert, I feel like is a really great collaborator in that way. And working on this Netflix show, Trinkets, I got to collaborate deeply with the Sarah St. Ange, who directed the first two and the last two episodes of the season. She was really tough and really focused, but getting to prepare with her was a real delight of TV that I hadn't experienced so much as a writer, like really having input on every single aspect of the production.
Yeah.
Was great.
I mean, that prep time is so invaluable.
Yeah.
And just feeling like you know, or that you have some kind of fucking plan before you spend a bunch of money and get a bunch of people in a place.
Yeah.
I wanted to get a little bit into Rafelson's philosophy of structure too, though, because you had mentioned earlier, and so I want to return to that, the opening shot of this, which is fixing the hair in a mirror, one eye in focus, one eye not, this kind of intricate shot that we're seeing. And he said, quote, and this is Rafelson, the first shot is to grab the audience, and the last shot is to redeem yourself. And then this article says, though Rafelson prepared for the opening shot by filming it 30 times with a video camera, it still proves to be a tricky piece of business. A complex optical effect that takes place in an airplane, a mock-up of a jet was built at Fox, and pivots around a magnification in the glasses of a woman applying makeup. The shot reveals the endlessly patient Teresa Russell to be a real pro.
It's such a good shot. I love it so much.
I mean, what's your philosophy of first and last scenes, first and last opening images and closing images? And like, what do you have a philosophy for that?
I don't know if for images. I mean, I talk to my life partner a lot about the generative image, you know, that idea that you get this picture in your head and then that can be the one thing that the whole story is built around. You probably have talked about that a little bit, but I find the closing, I mean, the opening image and the opening scene is always just much more polished because you rewrite it over and over and over and over again. And then the last scene is usually, I mean, oftentimes in Legally Blonde, the ending was reshot because I think when writers get to the end of a screenplay, they're tired because they've been writing.
Big secret, you guys.
They've been writing and rewriting the whole movie. And so sometimes they end up with like not a great scene at the end because of their fatigue of working on the rest of it. And oftentimes I've experienced that where it's like, we'll just figure out the ending later. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that's why endings get reshot, because we just spent too many other big fish to fry to worry about the ending.
Yeah, you're fucking tired. Or sometimes, like, your budget changes or something.
Right. I mean, in Legally Blonde, our ending was we had sort of a parade of people complimenting Elle at the end after she wins the trial. And, like, it was sort of like she was standing there receiving guests. And we screened that version and people were like, what is this? And then we recut it. And then we screened a version where she and Luke Wilson kiss at the end. And then audiences were like, fuck this. It's not about her getting a boy.
Oh.
It's about her finding herself and her own glory. So we had to reshoot, pretty close, a couple months away from release, a new ending where she finally tells Warner to go screw himself, and then she gives the graduation speech. All of that whole piece was shot in London, like many, many months after the principal photography was wrapped.
I always wonder, I mean, like, I wonder what the actors think of that every time they have to do, like, a reshoot, you know? They just, do they treat it like a job, or do they have, like, thoughts or opinions, or are they, like, is their opinion of the character changing for each kind of scenario because of, you know, what they chose to do?
I know. I would love to find out. I mean, I feel like actors have an amazing ability to, like, lock back in to the character. It mm-hmm. was funny on Legally Blonde because they were all wearing, like, different wigs. All of their hair had been cut and changed. So almost everyone in the reshoots wearing a wig.
Something that seems silly, but also, I think, great to talk about, because it's small, but it's really big in terms of this movie, that Ronald Bass said, I've never been a fan of a chyron that says 2 years later. It apologizes for what seems like a weakness in the story. It creates a lot of questions in the mind I prefer to ignore. We let the story tell itself, and if you care about the characters and what you're watching feels like a sensible progression, then...
I love that.
And I thought that would be something good to talk about in terms of the first kind of half of this story is time passing, time passing, yes. time passing, time passing. It's a structure that is kind of unlike other structures.
That's true. I just cut a 6 months or 2 months later out of a script yesterday.
You did.
So I am pleased to know that Mr. Bass would support this.
He would be like,
tactic. Yeah.
Brava. Yeah. Brava.
Take it out.
Yeah. I mean, apologizing for what seems like a weakness in the mm-hmm. story. That makes sense. The thing that I like about this movie, too, and something that I'm really happy that they didn't explain, is that Teresa Russell, we actually don't know why she's doing what she's doing.
We don't. And then there's even this, like, playful thing where Deborah Winger says her boss is questioning her about her own motive. Like, why are you so pursuing this case? And she says something about, like, she tells him a story about her dad beating her up. And she kind of tells it in this, like, grandiose way. And her boss, Terry Quinn, looks kind of sad about it. And then she's like, ha, 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 I'm just joking. Like, sometimes it isn't about that. It has yeah. nothing to do with that. So it's sort of a defiantly refusing to give backstories for either woman, which is neat.
I fucking love that. I love it so much. And actually, I'm writing a piece on that particular kind of thing that we do with female characters, where we constantly feel like we have to pathologize mm. or, you know, give mm-hmm. a sob story or make them abuse survivors. And, like, while yeah. that's true, you know, like, I would say most women that I know have survived abuse in some manner, but that's not necessarily what defines them. And sometimes when you put that in a script, it seems like that's the only thing that defines the character.
Yeah.
That's like the easy way.
In writing 10 Things I Hate About You, we got a studio note of, like, why is Kat such a bitch? Like, Julia Stiles' character. And her in our draft, her parents were married, and, you know, they were like, she was product of a pretty normal household, so we had to get rid of the mom, get her out of there, parents mm-hmm. divorced, single father, so she had some kind of wound that she was, like, pining for her
yeah.
mom.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. Sometimes girls are just bitches yeah. because they're feeling a lot of shit and the world is terrible.
Exactly.
Something that we should all remember. Yes. Thank you so much for coming and speaking with me today, Kiwi. And then people should be watching Trinkets on Netflix.
Yes.
And, you know, keep up with that. Take a look at some of the comics that Kiwi wrote as well.
Yes.
And anything else you feel like you want to plug?
Well, I would love for people to read the book that I wrote that Trinkets is based upon, which is out in the world again after the show. And it can kind of tide people over between season one and our season two, which will come out next year.
Awesome. Yeah. Take a trip to Barnes & Noble. And thank you again to Robert Fisher for the wonderful research materials. Please check out his short interview films. Specifically, this one is great with Ronald Bass on the UK Blu-ray that they have for Black Widow. Thank you guys so much.
Yay. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Can I borrow your hair?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.